You're listening to Lost and Found. I'm Jonathan Green. This week, we are off to Belfast, Northern Ireland's capital. It's a kaleidoscopic city, a place of contested history, a place seized with a desire to break free from that history. This year, that complex past has a significant anniversary, 100 years since the island of Ireland was formally partitioned between the Republic and Northern Ireland, which remains one of the four nations of the United Kingdom. In the decades after that moment, that one vision of the city, Belfast, became dominant around the globe. It's the one you might be familiar with, the bombed-out Belfast of the Troubles. Bloody sectarian conflict between Irish nationalists and British loyalists, as well as the British Army. It laid waste to thousands of lives, both inside and outside of Northern Ireland. It made central Belfast a no-go zone for many. Belfast today isn't that same city. That traumatic history, it casts long shadows, and it's where we begin today to understand how Belfast has changed since. One man who lived through and thought a lot about Belfast's tumultuous history is Glenn Patterson. He's a prolific writer, having published 13 books, radio plays for the BBC, co-writer of the BAFTA-nominated film Good Vibrations. Glenn's also the director of the Seamus Heaney Centre at Queen's University, Belfast.
I was born in 1961, and the Troubles arrived in the summer of 1969. And I remember in that summer seeing a Belfast on the front cover of a newspaper and having a moment where I realised that I sort of understood where I lived. I understood its place in the world. And I understood, too, that it was the object of considerable attention. And I think from that moment on, my childhood, my adolescence was lived with one eye on public realm and one eye on that very serious business of growing up, which you are being compelled by your hormones and everything in you to do. I was a very scared teenager and child. I was fearful of the knock at the door. I mean, you think of the vast majority of deaths in the Troubles here in Northern Ireland. People tended to die in no warning car bombings, attacks on bars, or being shot in their own homes. Knock at the door at night, people bursting in. And so some of those very, very mundane things were actually the most terrifying. You slept with one ear listening out for the sounds of cars turning into your street. I became a great measurer of distances with my right ear, the one above the covers, and trying to work out when something was coming close that oughtn't to be coming close in the night. So it did inflect rather than maybe infect all your days. And then there were things like bomb scares on a Friday afternoon, which it seemed like every Friday afternoon the whole city would grind to a halt as cars were abandoned around various points of the city. And you'd get off the bus and come in from school and walk up the road home. And there was just a kind of an atmosphere about those bomb scare Fridays that was very particular. And that just seemed to be part of the rhythm of those years.
He was blown to bits, out drinking in a curfew others obeyed, 3 nights after they shot dead the 13 men in Derry. Paras 13, the ball said, Bogside nil. That Wednesday, everybody held his breath and trembled. It was a day of cold, raw silence, wind-blown surplice and soutane. Rained on, flower-laden, coffin after coffin seemed to float from the door of the packed cathedral like blossoms on slow water. The common funeral unrolled its swaddling band, lapping, tightening, till we were braced and bound like brothers in a ring.
And that was the namesake of Glen Centre there, Seamus Heaney, reading an extract from his poem Casualty, published in his 1979 collection, Fieldwork. It was poetry that brought Heaney to Belfast, first as a student, then lecturer at Queen's University in the 50s and 60s. And it was Heaney's poetry that illustrated the complexities and casual violence of the Troubles, where the simple desire to have a pint in the city could leave you dead. As you hear in the case of the eel fisherman eulogised in Casualty. As Glenn explains, this poem voiced the feelings of many who were ambivalent about the tribalism of sectarianism and what strict binaries mean for civic life in Northern Ireland's towns and cities.
Yeah, Casualty is an extraordinary poem published in Fieldwork in 1979. It's a poem that's remembering a friend, an acquaintance, who was a night fisherman on Loch Ness and an eel fisherman who was killed in an explosion in the days following Bloody Sunday in January 1972. It's a memory of this particular man, but it's also a reflection too on the events of Bloody Sunday. But there is in that, I think, something of that questioning of what it means to be enlisted, to follow the calls, to follow a particular side. And I always thought that there was something. We lost so much of our city centres, our town centres, our village centres in the Troubles. A lot of the murders were attacks on bars, places of public resort. And I thought, thinking about people of my dad's generation, my mum and dad's generation, that there was something civic in the act of going out, of going for a pint, of going and being among other people. So that poem, Casualty, I think for me, as all good literature must, it speaks beyond the particular incident. And it brings to mind to me all those people who in those extraordinarily violent times insisted on living a civil and a civic life.
But what was Belfast like before the Troubles? Remember, this was the place that built the Titanic. Taking us there is Niamh Gallagher, historian, author and lecturer in modern British and Irish history at Cambridge University. She's also a member of the Independent Historical Advisory Panel for Northern Ireland.
Belfast is an industrial hub, not only within the island of Ireland, but across the entire United Kingdom. In many ways, it's more like Glasgow than it is like Cork. It is a major centre for trade, for manufacturing. Shipbuilding was the really renowned trade within Belfast. You think of Harland and Wolff, the very very famous shipbuilding manufacturers who built the Titanic, for example. I mean, Belfast was really modern. It was a modern city. It had electric lighting before many other places did. It was very much the centre of imperial industry across the UK. However, the UK suffered considerably under the First World War, and its finances were actually completely blown apart. So while the Empire survived that war, it was in a lot of trouble. That changed the nature of Belfast's economic capability right throughout the 20th century. You do see an industrial boom, I suppose, during the Second World War, where you have full employment and the manufacturing industry is sort of rekindled as ships are needed. You know, various other aspects of the war effort can be done and built within Belfast. But after that, I mean, really, there's been this perennial problem throughout the 20th century where Belfast's economy never recovered because of the world wars, but also because in this 20th century, the United Kingdom itself was no longer a manufacturing centre. The United Kingdom itself gradually switched to being a service-led economy, which Belfast, of course, never managed to follow through in doing that.
Northern Ireland has today pulled back from the brink of chaos, a chaos of violence which less than 2 weeks ago the Prime Minister, Captain Terence O'Neill, described as an imminent threat, while other voices around him spoke openly of the danger of civil war. With a resounding vote of confidence from his Unionist Party MPs here at the Stormont, Northern Ireland's Parliament, Captain O'Neill has weathered this particular storm. Public opinion has rallied behind him, and the extremists are for the moment in retreat. but the divisions remain. Bitter political and religious enmities which for more than 300 years have been Ulster's miserable heritage.
Belfast was a central place within the Troubles and effectively was bombed every week. I mean, it was a dreadful place to live in. And there was incredible segregation as the Troubles caused Catholic families to move out of Protestant areas and vice versa, creating a more sort of black and white demographic. But the Troubles is very misunderstood and it's just painted as a conflict between Protestants and Catholics. And of course, that's a part of it, but that is not really the central underlying reason for the Troubles. The Troubles implies it's one single entity that didn't change. But in fact, it is a very dynamic event that's very responsive to contingent events that accelerate momentum and cause people to make decisions they probably wouldn't have made ordinarily. But it wasn't the only form of politics happening within Belfast. There were lots of alternative peace movements, women's groups, all the things that were trying to get together that cited a very different line, one that wasn't about the constitutional question or by political and religious differences. So I think it's worthwhile remembering that it isn't just one question within Belfast. There were other political movements trying to put forward new alternative ideas of what a future might look like. And we're very accustomed to thinking of Belfast as a demographically divided city, a city that therefore is divided along political lines and religious lines. But it is quite important to remember that that itself wasn't a dividing line in many different episodes across the centuries. So it's not a picture, it's not a static picture of demographic differences and divides that have been there for hundreds of years. It's certainly more fluid than that.
It's peace, but at a price. 36 hours of non-stop negotiations to end more than 30 years of conflict. But in the end, Northern Ireland's political parties have struck an historic peace deal. The agreement is designed to end the bloody sectarian violence in which more than 3,000 people have died. But amidst the euphoria, there's been a reminder that it won't be easy to purge the prejudices of more than four centuries.
Ever since that Good Friday Agreement was struck in 1998, fluid identity has been baked into the fabric of Northern Irish life. Under the terms of that peace deal, it gave everyone in Northern Ireland the choice to choose their citizenship to be Irish, British, or both, while the Irish border was effectively rendered invisible. For almost 20 years, this fluidity ran uninterrupted, until Brexit complicated the idea and made the invisible border visible again. With decades of relative peace in Belfast, what city has emerged in the time since?
One of the unusual things for me about Belfast is that it's a small provincial city, although it figures widely on the news media broadcasts. It's actually a small provincial city. And one of the nice things about it is that from my house, I can get up into the hills, which are like open moorland, and I can get down to the sea all within about a 15-minute walk.
Neil Jarman is director of the Institute for Conflict Research, an independent research organisation based in North Belfast. He's also involved with the Belfast Mobility Project, which analysed GPS data to understand how the city's sectarian segregation continues to manifest.
You can't deny the history and the legacy of the conflict in this place. You can't deny that the city has deep sectarian roots. In many respects, it's quite schizophrenic. You can live in the city quite comfortably without a sense of the legacy of the conflict, without really encountering sectarianism on a day-to-day basis. On the other hand, sectarianism can dominate your daily life and the way you think about the city and the way you move about the city. You can divide that in some ways between living in a middle-class environment and living in a working-class environment, because the conflict was played out in Northern Ireland in working-class communities and involved working-class communities. So we've done work in the past where we've spoken to young people who have to know the overt and covert boundaries around their area, and that can make them feel very trapped. They don't feel comfortable moving out of their area. They don't feel comfortable navigating the commercial centre of the city. But having said that, things are changing. People have become more tolerant. You do see individualized symbols of identity within the commercial city centre where people go shopping in a way that you wouldn't 20 years ago, where you wouldn't have seen sports shirts, which clearly mark you out as a Catholic, as a Protestant. Nowadays, you do. People feel more comfortable in certain areas expressing their sense of identity. The centre of the city was a ghost town for 25 years. It's now thriving, vibrant, and the clubs, the bars, the restaurants, the social venues attract people from all different backgrounds. The key back to there is if you can afford to access it. So it does come back to class at that point. That has been a significant change. It's also been a significant challenge for people because, again, 20 years ago, Belfast was very white, although it has had long-standing minority communities, Jewish, Chinese, South Asian, that tended to be small. Nowadays, the population from minority ethnic population is much larger and much more visible, and much more visible in all parts of the city. I'm constantly pleasantly surprised when I see the visible variety within the city. And that's changed in terms of restaurants, it's changed in terms of culture. It's created some problems in terms of assimilation for some people, in terms of a significant undercurrent of racism and hostility expressed through forms of hate crime. But it has made people challenge their perceptions. And to some extent, I think it has been a factor in the breakdown of a sense of Northern Ireland being about two communities and binaries. It has taken time for Belfast to move away from its conflict, to recognise its simple dualities. But what you can have, I suppose, is don't focus on necessarily the dominant negative voices. Finding spaces for some of those smaller communities to emerge and establish themselves. We talked about the minority ethnic community, but the LGBT communities have also grown in scale and confidence to the extent that over the last few years, the largest public event in the city is actually the annual Pride Parade. And that itself has become an event that draws people from both white majority communities to support and spectate and participate. So that alongside the traditional sectarian divisions, you also find this fracturing and splintering, black and minority ethnic communities, LGB and trans communities, and a recognition within the population that you can be both, on one hand, sectarian, but on the other hand, that doesn't necessarily mean you've got to be homophobic or racist. So you do have a more complex process going on.
Now, in the aftermath of the Troubles, there's been a wealth of cultural production commemorating and analysing that conflict. But Belfast is home to a wealth of other stories. There's one organisation helping to collate them in a different way, and that's through architecture. It's called the Belfast Buildings Trust, a charity that rehabilitates the city's built heritage, then offers those places up for community use. Shane Quinn is its development director.
Belfast is a largely Victorian, Edwardian city. It's the kind of big commercial buildings that you'll see in the city centre are from the late 1800s, early 1900s. So a lot of what we do is obviously then through Victorian, Edwardian buildings. But for the Trust, it's very much about what is already here, what is authentic about Belfast, whether that is the last remaining Georgian buildings or red brick terraces that are the feature of kind of inner city core and suburban Belfast. So not at all about a particular style, but simply about saying what already exists. Someone created it. People created it. It meant something to people at a particular point in time, whether that's, as I said, a big commercial building or a red brick terraced house where generations of families have lived. And that has to be a really important bit of how we tell the story of Belfast over the past and what it means for the city in the future. Another of the buildings that we are currently working on that hasn't been... I suppose we're doing a phased set of work on that, is the former Carlisle Memorial Methodist Church. And again, late Victorian, built in the 1870s by William Lynn, was the architect, and very much a gift from a gentleman called James Carlisle, who was a member of Belfast Corporation, the former kind of precursor to our current city council, built by him with his wealth from linen, which Belfast largely has its wealth from, and it was his gift to Belfast, was known as the Methodist Cathedral, very untypically Methodist church, big, towering, Gothic spire and vaulted ceiling. But it closed in June 1980. The Troubles, obviously, what we euphemistically refer to as the Troubles, obviously had a big impact on Belfast in terms of population and people moving around. And that kind of story then of the decline of churches and churches closing is another part of that narrative of the Trust. But I go back to that point of all of these buildings have meant something to someone. They all say something about the social history of the city and the changes that Belfast has gone through. So just because the city changes and the use of buildings changes, for the Trust, we would argue very much doesn't mean that they need to be lost. In fact, it's even more important that we find a new use for them and that they continue to tell that story of this, of the changing city.
One beneficiary of the Trust's work happens to be an Australian. His name is Cameron Menzies. He's the newly appointed Artistic Director of Northern Ireland Opera, young company formed in 2010. Cameron moved to Belfast from Melbourne in the middle of a lockdown late last year, but as you may have heard, the UK is opening back up. Good news in Belfast. In a week's time, Cameron will be staging Northern Ireland Opera's run of La Bohème at the rehabilitated Carlisle Memorial Church.
The first few weeks I was walking around thinking, oh dear, like what have I done? But, you know, as the city's opened up and you know, cafes are opening and you know, live performance is slowly coming back to Northern Ireland, there's a huge buzz. You know, people are coming out while things are still very carefully kind of looked after and restricted and you know, showing vaccination cards and things like that. The city is certainly opening up and live venues are happening. The Lyric Theatre, which is the national theatre here, have got their first few shows going on. And I went and saw one of those, which was lovely to sit in a live theatre. But it's really starting to show itself. And we've actually just started this week our first rehearsals for our live production of La Bohème in September. Obviously, you know, Northern Ireland has a certain history, and one which I know very little about. I mean, I know sort of general history about it and I've read about it, but I certainly haven't lived that history. And I feel like not necessarily being a part of that or kind of linked into that so personally allows me slightly more freedom sometimes to suggest things or to look at things in a different way. And I've never been here, so everything I'm looking at is fresh and new. So, you know, all the ideas that are coming are fresh and new. So I think also there's a real openness to, especially in the arts community, I think in the younger generations that I'm talking to, there's a real need and a real understanding to acknowledge what has passed and what has been and understand it, that it's not what I find the younger generations want to take forward. So while it's part of their history and it's a very, you know, it's still, you know, in some ways very alive here, I don't feel that people are holding themselves back with it.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, this time Belfast. For more on the UK and Ireland, find Lost and Found episodes on Galway, Glasgow, Brixton and urban London. They're all for you on the ABC Listen app. You heard this time from Glenn Patterson, Seamus Heaney, Niamh Gallagher, Neil Jarman, Shane Quinn and Cameron Menzies, along with clips from the ABC News archives. Producers are Lisa DeVissi and Alan Whedon. Technical production by Brendan O'Neill. I'm Jonathan Green.